call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 8th, 2017. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present: Vice Chair Senator Coghill, Senator Meyer, Senator Stedman, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Hughes, and myself, Senator Giesel. Possibly Senator Will Crosby will be joining us shortly. So, thank you to Ann and Matt who are helping us out today. Today we're going to continue our discussion of federal issues that the state of Alaska is disputing or litigating with regard to access and use of our lands, waters, and subsurface rights. This is a continuation of the meeting we held on February 15th, and the materials that the committee has left over from that hearing. I think you've got some new copies of it, reprinted copies. So joining us today, Attorney General Jonah Lindemuth, and Assistant Attorney General Kent Sullivan. So thanks so much for joining us. We intentionally left some of the more contentious and complicated issues until today. So I will let you proceed, General Lindemuth. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Giesel. And we are working from the table I did January 23rd, 2017, called List of Federal Issues and Conflicts, which I believe you all have. And if I may remind everyone where we were, We covered navigable waterways, most of the access and land cases. And we left pages 4 and 5, some of the access and land cases on page 4, and then the Endangered Species Act cases on page 5. And then we finished up and had already covered the rest of the cases, so the water cases, the fish and game cases, the mining cases, and the oil and gas cases. So just that's the committee where we left everyone. So. We can start with on page 4, the lands and the trust issue. And so, where we were is that, in the Akishak litigation, several Indian tribes filed a federal lawsuit against the federal government saying that the Alaska exemption that disallowed Alaska tribes to take lands in the trust was illegal and should not exist and was inconsistent with federal statutes. The federal government fought that, and Alaska intervened on the federal government's side on that case. A federal district court ruled against the federal government and Alaska's position, and what happened then was the key issue is that the federal government then changed its mind. And it said, we agreed and we're going to go forward in compliance with this federal order that we just got. And so they changed their regulations to allow Indian tribes in Alaska to take lands in the trust. And the basis of that federal decision basically is that there's no basis for treating tribes in Alaska differently than tribes in the rest of the United States. And that was the underlying issue that that court dealt with. Now, once the federal government changed sides, I did two things for Alaska's position. One, it really left no case in controversy because the original lawsuit had been between the tribes and the federal government over that issue, and sort of mooted out the controversy. But it also meant that we had a new federal regulation interpreting federal statute that was contrary to the position that Alaska was taking in that case. And that's a very hard. It's a hard legal battle to fight. It's a really uphill battle. So that's where we were. And there was, when I joined as Attorney General in August of last year, we were facing a deadline of whether to appeal the Ninth Circuit's decision that had ruled that that case was moot and that procedurally Alaska was out of luck. And so I came in and met with my folks, got briefed up on the issue, and then met with the governor and lieutenant governor. And how I approach litigation, I just covered this in Senate Judiciary with Senator Coghill, but how I approach litigation generally is, although the attorney general may have the statutory and authority to make final decisions in any particular litigation, it's something that you want client involvement with no matter what, and you want to have consistency. As attorney general, I don't want to be doing something that the governor or any commissioner who I'm representing disagrees with and takes a contrary view. I want there to be consistency with what we do. So I met with the governor and lieutenant governor without getting into the details of our conversation. My legal advice to them was consistent with the policy decision that they then chose to make, which was to not fight lands of distress on a global matter as a absolute bar to something that can be allowed in Alaska, given the issues that proceeded here, but rather to deal with this on a case-by-case basis. And so that's where we are today. And what will happen then and going forward is that the federal government, whenever it receives an application to build lands of distress, and it's one that the federal government is ready to move on, will give notice of that it has received an application and allow both the state and any local governments to comment. And although it doesn't say this in the regulation, anyone can comment. It's not limited to states and local governments. And so if there is a native corporation that's impacted, if there's a resource project that would be impacted, anyone can weigh in on that particular application. And the way that lands in the trust works is that it's not an absolute right for any Indian tribe to have any particular parcel taken into trust. It's something that's completely within the discretion of Interior and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And so there's no, if the Bureau of Indian Affairs says, no, we're not going to do this particular parcel, there's no right for them to appeal and to challenge that particular decision. It's completely discretionary within the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And dealing with this on a case-by-case basis and actually sitting down with Interior and working through these issues and with Indian tribes and with all of Alaskans, I think we actually are in a better position to advocate for what we want as a state to happen with lands and the trust in a particular instance, and to have a better say and have our objections heard by Interior when an application is put forward if we're working collaboratively and openly on these particular issues and working through any concerns that are raised. What often happens in litigation is the parties take very polarized positions. They predict the worst case scenario, that if this goes forward, it's going to be the end of the world and X, Y, Z will happen. Well, what happens is if you lose in that particular instance, you actually brought that on yourself because you are now, all the horrors that you predicted will now be what you're facing in a particular litigation. And so one of the things to consider in whether to go forward in litigation or to work issues more collaboratively and to work through them and try to see if you can resolve disputes is that you may end up in something where you have a more nuanced approach to the issue and that you can take a more middle ground on where it lands and have your absolute issues, the ones that you really care about the most, addressed. Now, yes, Senator Crowfield.
I think the idea of coming is appropriate and fine. But you can just give us a context to that. For example, if the state comments and the citizens comment, is that equitable comment? The state have any more standing, less standing? Does the tribe have any more or less standing? If it's completely the discretion of Department of Indian Affairs, is it? Or DOI, whoever it is. I'm just trying to get a context to if the state comments, because we have a tax situation that may be very different than, say, a local business person. Mm-hmm. So just give us context on that, and that's probably best for me at this point.
Thank you, Senator Cotto, through the chair. The issues, my understanding, having sat down with those at Bureau of Indian Affairs, is that they really don't want to have a controversial parcel. And if there are legal issues that the state raises, those are certainly things that can be challenged in court if the Bureau of Indian Affairs goes against us and doesn't address that concern adequately or allows it or our objection. But the issue of how they move forward on this, I think that they have had issues, I think, in the lower 48 where they end up in litigation on every particular parcel. And I think that they are generally trying to avoid that and work more collaboratively with states to avoid that particular issue. This is all my comments thus far are with discussions with the prior administration. And one big question going forward is what this next administration does with this. And Secretary Zinke and his, whatever team he puts in place, may take a completely different view of this, and we may see very few, if any, applications move forward in this next 4 years. And that's just something that we'll have to see how that next secretary deals with.
Just understanding.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
It's just a remaining open question on how much weight our voice counts. So as we go through the process, but I don't want to nominate a time limit.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Though, of course, the question that is in my mind, this is the Resources Committee, the implications for resource development in our state. Can you comment on that?
Senator Chair-Giesel, Madam Chair, that's certainly an issue that's at the top forefront of my issues and of this administration. I mean, obviously, Governor Walker is very pro-resource development, and that's a huge issue moving forward. I actually think that, and that is something that we would actually, that would likely result in an objection if it were going to be, on the pipeline corridor or some sort of issue like that. But I actually think going forward, this will actually be a fairly small issue given the amount of land available for Indian tribes to put into trust as it currently exists. So just big picture, we have 330 million acres in Alaska of land, approximately 60% federal lands already, 28% owned by the state, and 12% owned by ANCSA corporations. And there's less than 1% owned by private parties, which includes Indian tribes. So the Indian tribes fall within the less than 1% of land ownership. Now, the big question that then raises is ANCSA corporations and the significant amounts of lands that they have given. And the ANCSA statute and working with regional corporations on ANCSA issues is something that I have a long history with. And the purpose of providing ANCSA lands to both regional corporations and village corporations is to provide a source of economic development for those corporations, and which often then leads to resource development on those lands. The significant legal issue that I think is remaining that's out there still is whether a split estate could be taken into trust. So let's say a village corporation transfers lands to a surface estate to a tribe, and then the regional corporation still owns the subsurface estate, which is the dominant estate, and it wants to do resource development. I actually think that the ANCSA is contrary to allowing lands into trusts. Now, that is an issue we talked through with Interior, and they take the view, at least with the prior administration, that split estates is not a problem if they do it in the lower 48. But again, they don't have ANCSA in the lower 48, and that's a whole different. The split estate where you have a mineral reservation or some sort of mineral assignment is a completely different beast than ANCSA lands. And so, and there's nice circuit authority on the whole subsurface state and what that means, and it is a greater right than normal mineral assignment or reservation that you see in the lower 48. And so I think that this is an issue going forward. Talking through with regional corporations, I don't know if there's a uniform position on this, but most of them do also believe that it's not possible for a split estate to be taken into trust. And so if something like that were to be proposed, I actually think that's something that the regional corporation that's impacted would object and potentially litigate itself. And I think that you probably see the state in weighing in on that particular issue in favor of resource development and not impacting or creating a situation where some Indian tribe who has a surface estate taking more off of the resource development project, whether through tax or through other types of fees that are inconsistent even with the Fed and I sharing that it results from resource development from those subsurface assets. So that's one of the huge legal issues that remain that isn't resolved yet and may not arise for many years yet until that actually is teed up. And I do think it's one of those things that I tried to start the discussion on this. We had a panel at AFN where there was an Aaron Chet, who's the president and CEO of Duran, was on the panel. There were others on the panel, and this was one of the issues that were debated. And I do think if there's a consistent thought on this particular issue, it is something that we could see a federal regulation address and just clarify the issue without the need for litigation to kind of set the rules before we get to an issue like this. That's a possibility.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I see here there's the issue down in downtown Craig that's cited in your little synopsis here. And for those that are familiar with that, there's a parcel, about an acre or so in downtown Craig, and that's been worked out between the city of Craig and the Travel Association there. So that's not, I guess, the issue at hand is pretty much rectified, but there is concern throughout the region on how this is going to work within our communities, the cash economy communities, when properties could be taken off the tax rolls, and how does the community absorb that in these small towns? Because we still have to provide, City Hall still has to provide services for the community, so there's some concern about that. And could you address that a little bit, what you've seen or ran into in that arena? And I guess Craig was the first community, but there, pretty much every community I know in the Southeast has tribal lands within it, and their population, a significant population of the community are members of this tribe.
So, Senator Hishan, through the chair, that certainly is an issue that needs to be addressed, and that is one of those things that can be, that a local government can address in its objection and to work through. I actually participated in a panel before the Municipal League in the fall, I think that was in November, speaking to municipalities across the state, and there was a panel of diverse views on this. And one of the things that I was recommending then, and I think that it's consistent with what the Department of Interior is recommending, is that the tribes should approach both the local governments in the state early before they actually file their application and work through these issues and talk through the concerns with the local governments. And if the local government hears of a potential application, contact the new tribe before it's actually noticed near their 30-day deadline. Because what can happen is that when there's a tax, a concern that a parcel be taken out the tax rolls, there can be a payment in lieu of taxes, and so there can be an agreement beforehand worked out that the Indian tribe will pay, make a certain payment. It's not quote a tax, but it's a payment in lieu of tax. And so that kind of agreement can be worked out. And the benefit to the tribe is that then the municipal government then doesn't file an objection on that basis if they have an agreement. So there's an incentive on both sides to sit down the table and work through those issues and address that. I think in that particular issue of Craig, that they actually weren't on, that particular parcel wasn't on the tax rolls, and so that wasn't actually a concern raised by the city of Craig. I do think that the city of Craig did file an objection on that, and their objection was just overruled by Interior. So it wasn't sort of on a legal basis. It's more that they just wanted more time to figure out how this was going to impact them and that what was going to happen.
Madam Chair, Mrs. Volk, as I recall my conversations with the administrator of Craig, I think that parcel, you're correct, was not on the tax rolls, but that was a policy call locally that Craig had to help the Native Russians and the Tribal Association because of, tough for them to pay the taxes on large tract of land in the middle of town, and they didn't want them to lose it. So the community worked with it, worked with the tribe, but it's, all these instances are going to be different in each community, and that's the biggest concern that I've heard from all my communities on this particular issue, is how do we deal with it? How do we deal with the impact of municipal revenue? Because somebody has to pay the bill.
Thank you, Senator Stillman. General Lindenmuth, this is, of course, the Resources Committee. My concern is that this is a slippery slope, and there were lots of folks that were very concerned that the state did not contest this case. Now, this committee, the Resources Committee, actually did do a confirmation hearing for your predecessor because your work affects resource development. And one of the questions I'm going to ask you, we asked your predecessor. And the reason it comes to my mind is that you just talked about how you talked with the different departments and the governor as far as whether to go forward contesting the Akinchak ruling. So my question to you is, as the Attorney General for the state of Alaska, who are you serving? Do you stand in service of the governor or the people of Alaska?
Madam Chair, this is an issue we just addressed again in Senate Judiciary, and my answer is both. And it certainly is the people of Alaska at the end of the day, but the highest elected official for the people of Alaska is the governor. And so as far as making policy calls for their highest elected official, that's something that, between the governor and the Attorney General who's just appointed, between the two of us, that's something that more elected officials should be doing on a day-to-day basis. Now, again, there are obviously instances where, as Attorney General, I do need to be involved in policy calls, and I do need to be working keeping in mind that the public is the first and foremost client. And there are many issues where that could come up, but the governor's not even involved in any particular issue. So there's, for example, really cases where a regulatory, for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, where the Attorney General is charged with protecting the public interest. And that's the bottom line statutory. And so there's no client in that other than the public. And so those are the instances where, we're in there doing that work, and there isn't a client that we're helping to represent in any particular instances. But there are other cases, as I covered in Senate Judiciary, as Attorney General, I wear many different hats, and there are many different clients in the state of Alaska because the Attorney General's office represents all of Alaska, including boards and commissions and the like, who don't fall within the purview necessarily of control of the governor. And so, for example, I have an assistant attorney general who provides legal advice to the Board of Game and does it on a regular basis. And that legal advice is given to the board as a client, and there can be instances where we have conflicts between different departments or different boards, and you have to appoint different people to represent those interests. And so it's a little tricky to keep track of who your client is in a particular case. And so that's definitely an important issue. And, drawing on my experience in management of breach of fiduciary duty cases in private practice, when you're dealing with a corporation, for example, you have a CEO or a president or you have a board, it's always, are they acting for the best interest of the shareholders? And that's the bottom line question in any particular case. And if so, then they get to make the policy call. But if there's an issue where you don't think that that's happening, or if there's some issue, then as the council involved in that, then you need to draw that line and make sure you are watching out for, in that particular case, the shareholders, or in this particular case, the citizens of Alaska.
Thank you. You are aware, I'm sure, of the controversy of an appointed attorney general versus an elected, which is certainly an independent. I'll let you go ahead and proceed.
So back to the chart and covering the lands and the trust issue. We brought with us the objection or the comments that we filed, the response that we filed for the City of Craig, for the Village of Craig application. And so I thought that might be useful for this committee, if that would be helpful. And I also brought with us a two-page overview of lands and the trust that we prepared for all of the different departments that we're serving. And it gives a short overview of what lands and the trust is. And then it's secondarily, it's also the document that we're using with our client departments and folks to solicit impact on any particular application that's filed. So I thought that would be useful for the committee to see, both for purposes of the legal, quick legal analysis of what lands and trust is, and also the procedural issue of how we're dealing with it at the state and soliciting impact so that we make sure that we have full comment, you know, full input on any comment given on any particular application. If folks have any questions on any of those, I'm happy to do it. Before we leave this issue, I am talking, you know, part of my charge with the governor and lieutenant governor was to do outreach to Alaskans and to folks just to understand what the concerns were so that that would help inform any comments that we put in, but also to educate folks and to work through any of the concerns that are raised. And, you know, in that, I've met with, I mentioned the Municipal League, I've presented to the Mining Association, I'm presented to the Resource Development Council later in the year on that issue, and also other federal issues that we're facing right now. I presented to AFN, was part of the panel that presented there. And even at AFN, it became clear that there's a lot of unknown issues about lands and trust, and it's, and even with AFN and with tribes themselves, it's a controversial issue. I don't see it being something that a huge amount of tribes are out running to do, and that there is, at least in your proclamation, I know that the keynote speaker at one of the lunch events basically spoke against it and thought that was very patriarchal for the federal government to hold land for tribes, and that was a loss of control in a way for tribes. So it's definitely a controversial issue that's out there, even for tribes. I, in talking with many tribal leaders, my take on kind of the impetus and interest in this at all kind of stems from the, you know, many court decisions over the years over the need for, in order for tribes to have jurisdiction over certain matters, say child protection matters, or, for example, that there would actually need to be a land base. And so that interest in their public safety and their communities and having a role and a voice in child protection issues and in criminal justice issues, I think is an impetus that is creates some interest in doing this. And as Attorney General, that's something that I want to talk about with tribes, of empowering them to be a more proactive player in public safety in their communities. And I think every local government should do that. But I think we have a specific charge to try to do that with Indian tribes because of the challenges that we face in rural Alaska public safety. And so if we can find solutions that give them some of that, empower them in those ways, say for the civil diversion agreement that I recently did with ANVIC, that takes low-level misdemeanor crimes and allows tribes to, at least civil diversion agreement, as the troopers or the law enforcement work directly with the tribe and having a consequence that's not necessarily within our criminal system, the civil remedy that the tribe then imparts, that I think that can help address some of these concerns, and actually we'll see less interest in land and the trust if they're getting that power to sort of address the public safety concerns in their communities in other ways and working with the state collaboratively on those issues. And so just big picture, I think that's a driving force behind this, and that we may see less interest if we find other solutions. Because round pegs, square hole, kind of the other way around. So I think that, in a nutshell, is sort of what's sort of behind this particular issue. Now, unless the committee has any particular more questions on lands and trust, I might move on to the next issue.
Well, actually, the lands and the trust kind of bring another issue up. I understand these are federal issues we're talking about, but we have an analogous issue between the state and access to resources through 2477, RS-2477, and the Platina Road. That, of course, isn't here because we're talking about federal issues, but perhaps you could give us an update on that subject. There's been a lot of concern. I know other committees have been contacted as well with concern of loss of that that very important access that the state of Alaska has jurisdiction over.
So I think there's been a bunch of, Chair Gisel, thank you for the question. I think there's been a bunch of misinformation and sort of fear over the fact that the state is in settlement discussions. There is no, currently, right, as we sit right now, we don't have a settlement. I thought of those issues, but I'm happy to update the committee. And just to put this in context, When we were here last on February 15th, Mr. Silverman did cover the chicken case, which is also a 2477 case that is against the federal government and is one that we had chosen to litigate to sort of get as the seminal case, if you will, on establishing 2477 against the federal government. So in the other case, to place this into context, we've been in litigation for 9 years. And Aetna filed a claim against the state 9 years ago. So this is not something that the state initiated. It's something that Aetna initiated 9 years ago and said, there's this, you know, from Copper Center to Lincoln Lake, there's a 24-mile road, and we don't think you have the right to access this. And so this is something that the state's been fighting and defending its rights for the last 9 years. We're almost $700,000 into that case. And we were looking at trial at the end of April. And what often happens as you approach trial is parties ask themselves, you know, what's the expense of taking this through trial? What's the risks and benefits? Is it worth sitting down and talking settlement to see if we can work something out that can work for both parties? And so that's what happened. So at the end of January, we had a full-day mediation with a professional mediator. And it actually went until 10 o'clock at night. And they still didn't have it worked out, you know, anything. So the party spent the next 2 weeks, and we were up against the deadline of this case pending, and it was my position that we wouldn't release that court date unless we had sort of a framework of what the decision points would be, even if we don't have a final settlement, that we'd have some framework that we were comfortable enough that we could actually get to a settlement if we took the trial off schedule. And so we reached that, I believe, last week or so, and that's when the notice was filed with the court, letting the court know that there was, the parties were working on a settlement, and that they jointly requested that the court take that off of the calendar. And so what we've given ourselves 90 days to work through the issues and to get to a settlement document. I'm sure the committee can appreciate that we're still in litigation. If we don't get to a settlement, we still need to litigate these issues. And so there's only so much I can say about, you know, the pluses and minuses of that particular case and why we would look at settling it. Now, I do want to point out that 2 years ago, I had lost an important summary judgment motion in front of Judge Weedy addressing the issue of scope of use. So in that particular case, Aetna had challenged the existence of that RS-2477. But it also said even if you have an RS-2477, you can't use it for anything but to drive it down the road and get from point A to point B as part of your right of way. So the secondary issue in that case is what can you do on an RS-2477? Judge Weedy's order still stands in that particular case, and if we were to take this through a 6-week trial, we'd still be facing an appeal to the Nassau Supreme Court to address this very issue. And one of the things that, you know, as you can appreciate, one of the things that we talk about in deciding whether to look at this and settlement, one of the things that's a factor for me is this the best vehicle to challenge this particular issue, or is this, you know, what's the upside or downside in challenging this? Now, if we do take this particular order and we lose this issue in front of the Nassau Supreme Court, and the court agrees with Judge Weedy, it means that the state has lost the ability to access all 2477s for fishing and hunting and for everything else, parking that is out there. And so, one of our goals in looking at settlement is just making sure that we're preserving the most access that we can and the most important rights that we can in looking at whether there's a compromise that's possible. And I do, without getting into the details, I do think that while there's some compromise that we're looking at in this, that we're actually preserving the most important rights that Alaskans want to see out of that RS-2477. I think it's important to talk about the process and how we deal with these issues. Because this particular litigation involves both the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Transportation as named parties. And then also the Department of Fishing Game is also involved. And so, you know, between with the law also, we're talking 4 different departments. And so it's a complicated issue to get client buy-in on this. And it's, you know, after the full mediation in 2 weeks of talking it out, when we got to something that we thought could work, it is something that we took to the highest levels. And so all four commissioners were involved, as well as the governor, in talking through and listening to the voices from everyone within the different departments about the pluses and minuses and what they want to see out of this. And something that all four commissioners and the governor agreed with is that we should consider settlement in this particular case. So that's where we're at right now. Once we do have a settlement, I'm happy to come back and talk through the settlement with this committee and talk more pointedly about the pluses and minuses in this particular case that led to desire to look at a settlement, if we get there and actually have a settlement. I mean, this is, it's early days yet, and we may not get there, and we may still be litigating this case.
I think the concern is once you reach that settlement and you have signed off on it, it's too late for public comment. When will the public be able to chime in? It's one thing for departments and the executive branch to speak to this, but it's actually citizens who will lose access to resources.
In looking through these issues, and I don't know that we should frame it as losing access, until folks see what the final, I know there's a lot of fear out there of what it's going to be, but until you see what the final settlement is, I think folks are fearing it's different than what it actually is. But I'm going to have my folks definitely look at all of the public notice and comment requirements associated with something like this, and we'll make sure that we follow it as part of the settlement process that we're doing. I don't have the answer about what that will be today, but I promise that the attorneys involved will look through those issues and make sure we're complying with the statutory and constitutional law on these issues.
Okay, thank you. I'll be collaborating with the judicial chair to keep track of that. Thank you. Any other questions on this topic or the Yakijak case? All right, I'll let you move on.
Okay, I think we'll next turn to Mr. Sullivan for the Anwar issues that are out there.
Thank you, Attorney General. Members of the committee, my name is Kent Sullivan. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the State of Alaska Department of Law and the Natural Resources Section. And as this committee is aware, an important concern at time of statehood was whether Alaska would possess the land and resources necessary to avoid becoming a ward of the federal government. And consequently, a high priority of the state is to ensure that it receives what it was legally entitled to from the federal government, pursuant to the provisions such as the Alaska Statehood Act, the Alaska Constitution, the negotiated and bargained for process resulting in statehood, and the NOFA. And despite the promises previously made, the federal government still owns over 229 million acres of land in Alaska and occupies over roughly 60% of the state. The federal government occupies more land in the state of Alaska than any other state in the country, certainly except for Nevada and Utah and Idaho. And so one area of concern is ongoing disputes with the federal government involving the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR. And one of those disputes that the state is focused on right now, and it's a high priority of the governor and of Commissioner Mack from the Department of Natural Resources, is boundary issues concerning ANWR and what is exactly ANWR consist of boundary-wise, and what is the state entitled to select with regard to its land selection, but it's not, that is not part of ANWR. And this is something that Commissioner Mack and the governor and the attorney general addressed recently, last week back in Washington, D.C., and so it continues to be a very high priority for the administration. And what the state is seeking to do is to ensure that it's allowed to select lands that it's legally entitled to from statehood. And the problem is that the state has looked at what the boundary of ANWR should be and has determined that the boundary is defined by the ordinary high water mark of the Cannon River. And there's no dispute on what creates the legal boundary of ANWR. both the feds and the state agree that it's an appeal out that originally withdrew the area prior to becoming a refuge to its predecessor, and then under that PLO, it basically said that it's the western bank of the Canada River. The dispute is, where is that exactly? And the state's fairly confident where that line should be drawn. Unfortunately, due to a surveying discrepancy on the part of the federal government, they define it as being something altogether different. They define it as being part of the Staines River, and the Staines River is another tributary altogether. And if you were to go with the interpretation that the federal government has suggested, that boundary would actually be located many, many, many miles to the west. That would go over Tundra. And so what I'd like to do is have this note from the law pass out a map that sort of helps you see this area.
Mr. Sullivan, if you could pause for a moment, we have a question from Senator Vandenhoff.
I think the map, because I think that was, I've flown in that area in a supercut, so I'm very familiar, and it is a couple hundred miles. It's very slow in a supercut.
And so if you take a look at this map, the first page, shows the boundaries of ANWR itself, and if you look in the upper left-hand corner of the first image, you can see a little area in yellow, and then you can also see that blown up in the inset. And so that's the area that we're talking about that's in the state. So this is, while it is a big area, as Senator Von Imhoff has mentioned, with relation to the overall refuge, it's a very, very, very small piece of ground for the refuge itself. In totality, it actually turns out to be about 20,000 acres, which is a fair amount of acreage. But if you then turn to the second page, this is a further blown-up image of exactly what's in dispute. And basically, the line being claimed by the state is the line shown in red, which goes from Brownlow Point out on the coast on the northern boundary of the refuge, all the way down to the south, and that total area is roughly 70 miles, I believe. And again, that's the western bank of the Cannon River. My best understanding is that the federal government is claiming that the Staines River is actually part of the Cannon River, and that therefore they're using the boundary of the Staines River, as you can see, but then the Staines River sort of is a much shorter body of water, and it eventually dries out into virtually nothing. And so in order to make the boundary work that the federal government has proposed, you have to take that boundary across open timber for many, 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 many miles, which again, when PLO defines the boundary as going along the bank of the river, it's a little bit difficult to do. And so the state is arguing that any confident surveyor should have been able to determine that boundary easily on the ground in the 1960s. And that's what the state is suggesting here, and has filed two cases before the IBLA. And those cases are ongoing and in dispute right now, but we're arguing that position, and basically we're arguing that the area in yellow is outside of the boundaries of ANWR. And because it's outside of the boundaries of ANWR, the state ought to be able to select those lands as part of the state's land selection process. And then once selected, and once those lands are lands of the state, then the state can do what it sees fit with those lands and look to them potentially for resource development or what have you. So that's the primary issues in those two cases. And they're proceeding along in litigation before the IBLA, and hopefully get those resolved in the not too distant future.
I have one, Mr. Sullivan. So I see on the first map, you have the 1002 designated. Do you know where that single well was drilled in the 1002 area?
Chairman, because I do not, I would have to get back with you on that. I'm not familiar with exactly precisely where that bill is in the county area.
Okay. Any other questions on this? All right. Seeing none, yes, thank you. This is great. Yeah, so I'll respond here.
And then I have one more issue that the state is addressing with regard to Anwar, and that is the 1002 area. And with regard to the 1002 area, Section 1002 of ANILCA set aside the coastal plain of Anwar for further investigation of its oil and gas potential. And back in the mid-1980s, Department of Interior and others investigated the potential of that area for oil and gas. But in doing so, ANILCA basically indicates that oil and gas production can't occur until approved by the Act of Congress. But based upon the investigations that occurred, Department of Interior itself recommended that the 1002 area be open for production. And at least as of this point, Congress has failed to pass a bill implementing those recommendations. So Senators Murkowski and Sullivan introduced Senate Bill 49, the Oil and Gas Production Act, on January 5th, 2017 of this year, that would allow exploration and production in a portion of that 1002 area. And so the administration continues to be very supportive of those efforts and are hopeful that at some point that's going to succeed, and Congress will authorize that as Department of Interior itself has recommended. So that's kind of what's going on with 1002.
Thank you. Any questions on that subject? All right. Yes, Senator Hughes.
I understand that Senator Murkowski and Sullivan met with the President today, and I'm hoping that topic came up, so I just thought I'd mention that. If you hear word back on that, I'd be curious.
Through the chair, certainly will follow up on that. I understand that occurred as well, and I think we're all anxious to hear how that went.
Good. All right, I'll let you proceed.
Thank you, Chucky. Well, so I'm just following up on that issue. So I actually was back in D.C. myself last week, and the governor was there, and then I was actually there for a different reason. But then while there, I met with all of our congressional delegation, all three of them. And I gave each of them the issues list that you guys all have here and encouraged them to watch the hearing that we had on this on February 15th and then today on these issues. And this again framed the discussion on many of the important points that the Walker administration is pushing with the federal government, the Trump administration, and through the efforts and with the assistance and help of our congressional delegation. So it's just, there's a lot going on behind the scenes. We're making some progress on these issues. And just to update on one of those issues, on the waters of the United States, I think that you saw last week that we had President Trump's order on that to have that issue, that rule reconsidered. And we're very hopeful that we'll end up with a good result for us on that particular thing, which again leads me into the Endangered Species Act cases, because I think that what we've seen with this Trump administration on a lot of these issues is a reconsideration of many of the things that went forward under the last administration. And so to update the committee on the Endangered Species Act, so we have it on page 5 and then it goes on to page 6. I want to do this in reverse order just because it makes more sense for purposes of a story to tell a story. So I want to start with the polar bear critical habitat case that was filed in 2013. And where that is that there, as this committee knows, there was a designation of polar bears and endangered species that covered 187,000 acres on the North Slope. And it's the state's position that that's far too big of a designation and far too much area, and that the science doesn't support that large of an area being designated. We challenged that in the Ninth Circuit and lost, and we filed a petition for certiorari to the Supreme Court, working with ASRC and the other Native corporations and tribes that are involved in that litigation. And that petition for certiorari is pending. And so that's not yet fully briefed, but I am, you know, we'll see what happens. I think that the Trump administration is trying to decide what position they're going to take on appeal. And so that, you know, how they move forward in defending that case before the Supreme Court may be time. The next case to cover is the Equitable Habitat case of the Alabama versus the National Marine Fisheries Service. Yes. And in that particular case, the state, we joined Alabama and 18 other states in filing a lawsuit challenging the new rule that defined critical habitat under the Endangered Species Act. And so what we saw with the polar bear designation was, you know, a huge designation in Alaska, and then the federal government changed the definition of critical habitat, which would then grant them greater power to designate even more as critical habitat by just redefining what's meant as critical habitat. And that's something that you know, we didn't take kindly to, and many other states didn't as well. So it's a multi-state effort. And that is a direct action. We're not filing as an amicus. We're actually a plaintiff in that particular case. Now, by filing in Alabama, one of the main things that we achieved by that is that it won't be the Ninth Circuit that reviews any particular decision that comes out of a district court case. And so instead it will be the 11th Circuit, and that's one of the main reasons we joined with Alabama and others in filing in that particular jurisdiction, especially since we lost the Florida case in the Ninth Circuit. Now, the status of that particular case is that it's been stayed by one of the parties to allow the new administration to get up to speed. And again, I think they're reconsidering what position they're going to take in that particular case. And I joined with many other state attorney generals who are involved in that litigation, asking the Trump administration to reconsider that issue. And we're hopeful that that will actually happen, and that will kind of follow along the lines of the Water of the United States rule that we saw last week, so that this may be the next one to follow that rule. The AG has also joined in that particular Water of the United States case and had issued a letter jointly that then President Trump responded to, and that was the impetus behind, I think, that being considered that rule. So we're hopeful that we'll see the same type of response here. Now, the last two cases are similar, in the bearded seal case and the ring seals case. And so in 2012, the National Marine Fisheries Service listed the, I'm going to get this wrong, Oxt distinct population segment. Is that how you say that, Mr. Solomon? You don't mean?
I don't.
It's a particular distinct population segment. And the Beringia distinct population segment of the bearded seals is threatened, so two different populations. And in 2012, that the National Marine Fisheries Service also listed four subspecies of the ringed seal as threatened or endangered. And there's, so there's two separate cases pending, one for the bearded seal and one for the ringed seal. The state is working with the Association of Oil and Gas Association and the North Slope Borough, and it has filed complaints on both of these issues. In both cases, we won at the district court level. For the bearded seal case, that decision was overturned at the Ninth Circuit case, and a petition for rehearing was filed on January 9th. And for the ring seal case, which is following behind, we're still at the briefing stage before the Ninth Circuit, but we don't hold out much hope at the Ninth Circuit given what happened with the other, with the bearded seal case. The problem with both of these cases and the way that the state's looking at this is that currently neither of them are threatened populations. And what the federal government has been trying to do is use the Endangered Species Act as a tool to address climate change. And it's not designed to address that particular issue. It's not, it's again, it's a square peg round hole type of issue. And the federal scientists, you know, did a climate model projections, they go 100 years into the future about what will happen to these populations. And That to us is not good science. I mean, if you think back 100 years ago and try to predict what the world would look like today, 100 years, hence, nobody would have gotten it right. I mean, it just, so to take healthy populations today and try to use this app, which is meant to protect species that are threatened today, for this particular issue is something that we think is inappropriate and is shouldn't be used this way. And we're hopeful that this, that the new administration again will see more eye to eye with us on this particular issue. So we'll see what happens in these two cases. So unless the committee has any further questions, that really concludes what we plan to present today. But we're certainly willing to talk about any other issues or address any other concerns that the committee has. Committee members, any further questions? Looks like not.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, General Lindemuth and Mr. Sullivan. Appreciate it. So with that concludes our agenda for today. We will be meeting on Friday, March 10th at 3:30, our usual time. We're taking out the confirmations of former Senator Hollis French and Dan Seamount to the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission at that meeting. So this committee will stand adjourned today, and the time is 4:26 p.m.